Chapter 15. Jin still lived in the cave in her mind, but it was larger now, so large it felt like it could contain worlds and armies, and so filled with light from above that she didn't feel trapped at all. She could only hope it wouldn't close on her again, not before the mission was over, not before she was through with Scarif. Jin was climbing into the cockpit as the shuttle lurched out of light speed. The azure mists of the hyperspace tunnel collapsed beyond the viewport, and stars streaked into visibility, fixed into place by real matter and real gravity. In the center of the stellar vista was a planet wrapped in deep blue oceans and speckled with clouds and rocky archipelagos. If not for the massive ring-shaped orbital station above the northern hemisphere, Scarif would have looked almost pristine.
"Okay," Bodhi said. "We're coming in."
He sat beside K2SO at the console, waving Jin between them with barely a backward glance. It was strange, Jin thought, to see him so confident, so comfortable. "What am I looking at?" she asked, squinting at the ring. She made out the specks of starships descending through its center, but then a shimmer outside the ring's edge caught her eye. The subtly distorting gleam of an energy field. "There's a planet-wide defensive shield with a single main entry gate," Bodhi said. "The shuttle should be equipped with an access code that allows us through."
"Assuming the Empire hasn't logged it as overdue."
"Or stolen," Bodhi said.
"And if they have?" Jin asked.
"Then," Bodhi answered, "they shut the gate and we're all annihilated in the cold, dark vacuum of space." Jin let out a huff of a half-laugh. She was starting to like the confident, comfortable, and cynical Bodhi.
"Not me. I can survive in space."
Jin dug her fingers into the back of the cockpit seats and tried not to lean in. The shuttle veered gently in the direction of the gate, and the specks swiftly grew larger. The great wedge-shaped masses of twin star destroyers loomed like monstrous statues over the orbital station's portal, dwarfing the swarms of cargo shuttles and transports and TIE fighters. Jin tried to remember the last time she had seen so much Imperial activity in one place, and failed.
"Okay, this is good," Bodhi said.
He glanced up at the Star Destroyers and then back to his scanners.
"It's not normally this busy. I think this is good. We're just one more ship. Nothing worth noticing."
Jin heard his confidence crack, then reassert itself.
"Okay, here it goes."
The shuttle's thrusters rumbled and the deck plating trembled as course locked. The vessel accelerated through the vast distance separating itself from the gate. Bodhi worked the comm with one hand and said without a hitch, "Cargo shuttle SW0608 requesting a landing pad." Jin straightened off the cockpit chairs and backed away carefully. Confident, comfortable, and Imperial. She might have wondered what Bodhi had been like, what any of her companions had been like before the Death Star, if she hadn't been intent on not making a sound.
"Cargo shuttle SW0608, you're not listed on the arrival schedule,"
the voice on the comm said. The operator sounded vaguely puzzled. Bodhi had a ready reply.
"Acknowledge gate control. We will reroute it from Edu Flight Station. Transmitting clearance code now."
Jin flinched as she heard a sound from the ladder into the cockpit. She glanced over to see Cassian, who seemed to sense the mood and paused in his climb. She knew enough about what the spy had been like before the Death Star. She wasn't sure if she'd forgiven him for it, or simply decided to abandon it, like a used-up blaster pack.
"Transmitting,"
K2 said. The console hummed softly and went silent as the dispatch finished. Cassian completed his climb, swift and hushed. Jin found her hand tangling in the string of her necklace, drawing the kyber crystal into starlight. Cassian had said, "We've done terrible things. If this went wrong now, if they failed before they'd even landed," Jin was sure the only unforgivable choice
would be her own. She wrapped her fingers around the crystal. She imagined praying like she'd seen Chirrut pray. She nearly laughed, dangerously loud, and squelched the sound.
Cargo shuttle SW0608.
The voice in the comm had returned.
You are cleared for entry.
Jin dropped the crystal and squeezed her hand in a fist, almost shouting in triumph. She spun and was startled to see Cassian standing close to her. On instinct, riding the joy of the moment, she grabbed his arm and squeezed.
He looked at her with a wry, curious smile. She dropped her hand and brushed past him.
I'll tell the others, she said.
The cave was getting brighter all the time.
Jin was changing. It was evident in her fluid movements and her lucid stare. She no longer hunched her shoulders, no longer maintained the compact posture of a woman ready to absorb a hit before she hit back. She'd shed none of her intensity, but it came with what Cassian could only interpret as a confidence bordering on invincibility. She'd always struck him as a person unafraid to die. Now she seemed like someone who couldn't. He should have been terrified of following her into battle. He no longer understood her, could no longer locate her old need for answers, her desperate grasps at meaning. Yet he'd faced down her loathing during the return from Edu, walked a razor-fine edge before the briefing on Yavin, uncertain what would happen after. He'd told the story of his mission before the Council. Jin had told the story of hers, and Cassian had realized that setting his sniper rifle aside had roused a hunger in him. He tried to imagine executing another coldly elegant mission for Draven and finding nourishment in the stale, momentary thrills of danger and triumph. He couldn't survive that way anymore. After realizing that, recruiting the rest of the team had been easy. Jin was changing, and through her, Cassian would do what was required of him. They all would.
Careful, you're starting to sound as zealous as Chirrut.
The descent through Scanroff's atmosphere was so smooth as to be almost unnoticeable, save for the slow fading of the stars and the paling of the sky from black to blue. The ocean below, once Cassian could see it, seemed utterly still. Only the telltale ripples of light suggested waves. The shuttle hurtled over the specks of jungle-riddled volcanic islands and finally slowed as it approached a wheel of landmasses connected by sandy tombolos and transit tubes. Other shuttles and starfighters circled the islets, spiraling down or rising from the 24 landing pads supporting the wheel's sprawling imperial installations. The layout was, so far as Cassian could tell, roughly as Bodhi had sketched out during the hyperspace journey. A voice came through the comm, bored and professional.
SW0608, clear for landing pad 9. Acknowledge, please.
SW0608 proceeding to LP9 as instructed, Bodhi said. The shuttle banked, dipping below the top of a monolithic imperial fortress rising from the centermost islet.
The main building down there, Cassian said.
What is it?
That's our goal, Bodhi said.
The Citadel Tower. Command and control for this whole facility.
Cassian was tempted to ask Bodhi to do a second flyby, but it wasn't worth the risk of drawing suspicion.
Can you access the shield gate from inside?
Don't think so.
But if the Death Star plans are anywhere, they'll be there.
They'd better be.
They'd built their whole scheme around finding the Citadel's data vault.
If by some chance Galen Erso had been wrong, if Bodhi was wrong now, if the Empire had moved the one data tape they needed to another location...
Movement caught his eye atop the tower. The subtle readjustment of a massive signal array.
And the dish at the top. What's it for?
Bodhi shrugged.
That's the communications tower. Every communication, in and out of the space, goes through that dish.
Normal transmissions can't penetrate the shield, and a normal rig wouldn't have the bandwidth to handle everything on base at once.
Cassian pictured the soldiers in the cabin below, scanned their faces and dossiers. He stopped at Corporal Pow. He had a vague recollection that the Spec Force Commando had taken out a similar comm unit in a demolitions job on Phorost. He made a note to ask him about it before leaving the shuttle.
"Landing track engaged,"
K2 said. Cassian stepped away from the viewport. He didn't expect anyone to spot him from the ground, but why take the chance?
"Security?" he asked. "How's it look right now?"
"I don't know," Bodhi said. "I've made 20 cargo runs in and out of the place. They've never let me off a landing pad, so I don't have much to compare it to. Security's tight."
Cassian watched green treetops and white beaches flash by. For an instant, he caught a glimpse of the boxy metallic body of an all-terrain armored cargo transport. A four-legged walker, whose militarized cousins he'd seen devastate bunkers. He'd almost never seen full-sized walkers outside a war zone.
"Well," he murmured, "we've faced longer odds."
"No,"
K2 said.
"We haven't."
There were almost 24 soldiers in the main cabin. 24 people waiting to fight and die. And all of them looked at Jin like Saw's troops had looked at him. She'd listened to their chatter during the flight, caught a handful of names. Many of the troops had fought together before as Special Forces Pathfinders. Some had worked directly with Cassian, while he'd sought others based on their reputations. A few had caught wind of the Scarif operation and volunteered to come along instead of turning them all in. The rebels who didn't know one another rapidly swapped war stories or jokes or barbs, bonding the way soldiers did. Or they sat alone, staring contemplatively at their hands. Private Calfor was a half-deaf grenadier who'd once owned a bloodhound kennel on Mykapo. Escro Kasich was a braggart and a glory hound, and Jin pegged him instantly as a man terrified of being the mission's sole survivor. An unassuming middle-aged man with a thick accent had tasked himself with inspecting every blaster aboard, polishing away carbon buildup and swapping out energy packs. A pale woman had started shouting at one of her teammates about how the Alliance was dead, how they were all traitors now, and then sat back down mumbling apology after apology. Corporal Tonk had spent half the flight at Bodhi's side, skeptically questioning the pilot about his suitability for the operation. Whether Bodhi was competent with a blaster, whether he'd seen combat before, before grudgingly declaring he'd be the one to watch Bodhi's back. Almost no one spoke to Jin unless she spoke first. Saw had always been above his people, a symbol of the cause. Now Jin had been pushed into that role. With a pang, she realized how much she missed the camaraderie of Saw's cadre. Not the people, not their bitterness and fanaticism, but the unspoken knowledge that they were bound together under one man's leadership. She sat beside Baze and Chirrut as the shuttle descended. She had them now, but it wasn't quite the same. She jumped when a hand tapped her shoulder, and she turned to see a broad sniper looming over her. She tried to remember his name. Cephla. "What is it?" she asked.
"Small problem with the troops,"
Cephla said. Jin waited.
"They like you, ma'am, but if you want to give a speech, they'll have trouble respecting you. You're not military. You're not even Alliance."
"Not really my problem, is it?"
Jin said, more nonplussed than irritated.
"Hardly the right attitude, ma'am."
Cephla arched his brow.
"Morale is everyone's problem. So if Captain Andor won't do it, it falls to me, as an Alliance Spec Force Lieutenant, to brevet you the rank of Sergeant. Congratulations."
Cephla never smiled, but Chirrut was laughing silently.
"You're a cretin," Jin said.
"Yes, Sergeant,"
Cephla replied, and walked back toward a cluster of Pathfinders.
"Guess I'm giving a speech now, too,"
Jin thought. She stood from her seat and began to pace. Let them watch. A short while later, Cassian clambered down the cockpit ladder.
We're landing, he murmured to her, and then called to the group.
We're coming in!
A dozen soft conversations came to an immediate end. The soldiers rose, tightened the straps of their rifles, and secured their equipment for the final descent. After the clicking of metal and the rustling of leather stopped, all too swiftly for Jin's tastes, their eyes turned to her. She'd failed to rally the Alliance Council. She wasn't much of a speaker. Fighting was all she knew. Maybe this was her perfect audience. She began, raising her voice above the rattle of the deck plating.
Saw Gerrera used to say, one fighter with a sharp stick and nothing left to lose can take the day.
No one heckled her. No one asked questions. A few Spec Force officers nodded.
They have no idea we're coming. They have no reason to expect us. If we can make it to the ground, we'll take the next chance. And the next. On and on until we win, or the chances are spent. The Death Star plans are down there. Cassian, K2, and I will find them. We'll find a way to find them.
There was no applause either, yet the soldiers looked proud and ready. She could have promised them their lives. She could have promised a great victory for the Alliance, but this was all she could offer, and she hoped it was enough. Cassian stepped forward before anyone's attention could drift.
Melshi, Pau, Baze, Chirrut. You'll take main squad, move east, and get wide of the ship. Find a position between here and the tower. Once you get to the best spot, light the place up. Make 10 men feel like 100. And get those troopers away from us.
What should I do?
The call came from Bodhi, climbing down from the cockpit and leaving K2 behind.
Keep the engine running.
Cassian said,
you're our only way out of here.
Assuming we make it back, Jin thought. She might have said it aloud, but she was sure they were all thinking it anyway.